Welcome to Future Makers, your invitation to cutting-edge debates on our changing society with leading thinkers from the University of Oxford and beyond. In 2010, Jeffrey Mazow published a book entitled How Global Warming Threatens Security and What to Do About It. In this book, he outlined four ways in which climate and environmental change could produce security threats. First, a general systemic weakening. Second, boundary disputes. Third, resource wars. Fourth, by multiplying instability in already fragile or weak states. Yet so far in Future Makers, in our conversations about energy use, international treaties, and individual choices, conflict has received much less attention. Is this a fair reflection of the relative risks, or should we be paying far more attention to these potential threats? In short, does climate change make global conflict inevitable? With me to discuss this today are Kate Guy from the Center for Climate and Security in Washington, D.C., and a doctoral researcher at the University of Oxford, who specializes in international relations and in particular on the intersection of climate change with national security, and Dr. Troy Sternberg from Oxford School of Geography and the Environment, whose research has explored how environmental and climate changes in the Gobi region of northern China and Mongolia have impacted on security in the Middle East. We were also going to be joined together by Dr. Rob Johnson, Director of the Changing Character of War Centre here in Oxford. But sadly, he's unwell. We hope to catch up with him in a bonus episode. So Kate and Troy, thanks for coming. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Before we get on to whether talk of conflict is realistic or not, I'd just like to set the context for the conversation. Kate, what are the pressure points that a changing climate can, and maybe already is, creating in different parts of the world?
Sure. So most of the literature and kind of policymakers that look at the intersection of climate and conflict or climate and security do so by classifying climate change as this big threat multiplier in the world. So it's difficult to look at the attribution of any conflict to a particular climate change, but the way to think about climate change as it's kind of increasing the existing threats and fragility that is already on the ground all across the world. So when you have big changes to resources, to weather patterns, to precipitation, to obviously sea levels and extreme weather hitting different parts of the world with increased frequency and intensity that climate change brings, that destabilizes existing tensions and existing conflicts that are already going on for a variety of reasons across the world.
So can you illustrate some of the ways in which that can happen, in which the threat does get multiplied?
Definitely. So if you have, parts of the world, this is currently becoming increasingly relevant in places like the Sahel in Africa, or, there have been people that have drawn distinctions in Syria and the civil war in Syria as having already been tense regions of the world, or already places facing migration or facing difficulties between, warring factions or just changes in livelihoods. When you have climate stressors increase with temperature increase in those areas, you might see those tensions become even more increased and really boil over the top. So what's happening in the Sahel is as pastoral farmers and herders have their livelihoods kind of stripped away from them as drought conditions increase in those regions. You have populations interacting with each other, moving further than they otherwise would have. Populations like in Syria, as happened in the Middle East, move into cities as they try to escape drought conditions that they were otherwise dependent on. And all of these changes in societies can lead to increased tensions where otherwise there weren't, or just make them boil over the top.
Right. And is drought here the main consideration, or other things like, maybe too much water, sea level rise and so forth?
Definitely. No, drought is a big one, just because, without water, many systems that depend on that water, from agriculture to human life, quickly get affected. But as you said, sea level rise is a big problem as well. And lots of cities on coasts, big centers of population on the coast, entire countries, if you think of small islands, they might see their entire livelihoods affected because of things like sea level rise. And where are those people going to go? What's going to happen to those economic structures which are dependent upon those regions? There's a lot of scary security issues when you think about that.
Right. And I suppose even if the overall effect of climate were neither positive nor negative, suppose it just meant that different regions became fertile and previously fertile regions became infertile, the fact that you've got national boundaries in the way could cause conflict, even if overall things are no worse. Is that right?
Yeah, this is exactly the problem with climate change, is its impacts do not recognize borders. They don't recognize different ethnicities or different cultures. And a problem could be contained to some area, which, potentially, if it hits an industrialized country, has the money and resources to adapt to that change. But are they able to adapt to other people moving into that area as their livelihoods are lost? No. And even beyond that, I think that a lot of what the research we're seeing says is there are no people that benefit overall from climate change. Everyone will face some risks and some, loss of something, be it from the global market or from their local livelihoods. And everyone is facing increased severity of different weather factors wherever they are.
Okay, just to clarify that last point then, I mean, obviously, whenever you get change, whenever you get disruption, it's going to have some negative impacts. But some people might think that in some parts of the world, things are going to get better. They're going to have warmer summers, say, or maybe an area that's currently dry may become less dry and therefore more fertile than it is now. Are you saying in general, the negative impacts are likely to outweigh the positive almost everywhere?
I think so. I mean, I think it's difficult to kind of try to tally up who are the winners and who are the losers from climate change, because everybody is facing effects in some way. I mean, if you look at countries like Canada or Russia, obviously their winters are getting not as harsh, but that also has negative consequences for things like insects that are dependent and these ecosystems that are dependent on winters being a certain, low temperature. Or you see kind of the permafrost collapse in northern Arctic regions. So there are some situations which might improve. Yes, you'll have not quite as harsh winter as Canadians, but also the systems that were dependent on that themselves are falling apart.
That's very interesting. Thank you. Troy, I'd like to hear a bit about your experience in a particular region of the world and its impacts.
Well, looking at the Gobi Desert, it's actually this vast part of landscape between Mongolia and northern China. It's quite neglected globally, but within there's many stories going on. And recently, a drought in the Gobi Desert and the surrounding area in China really had great impact, because what we saw is an extreme event then changes the food supply in a major power like China, which has knock-on effects in other parts of the world. So
how big a region are we talking about? You said it's vast. Can you give us a feel for how vast?
We're talking an area basically the same size as the Arabian Desert in the Middle East. So it's almost 3 million square kilometers. So
how does that compare with Europe?
So it would go from London to Moscow and from Scandinavia down to southern Italy.
Okay, that's huge.
Right. Okay. So you have this huge area, not highly populated, so doesn't receive a lot of attention. But what this case of drought and its impact on wheat harvest in particular shows is that climate events in one part of the world can have a significant knock-on impact in other parts of the world.
And when are we talking about?
There's a great example from 2010 at the time of the Arab Spring, where we see this extreme drought reducing wheat harvest in China. And China, being the largest wheat grower in the world, appreciates the importance to its society. So China has the ability to go on global commodity markets, acquire more wheat for its own population. But if we redistribute the wheat, then that means there's less for the Middle East, and particularly a country like Egypt, that's the world's main wheat importer.
So, gosh, and we're talking about one specific year where this happened.
Right.
You get a drought in the Gobi Desert, not enough wheat is grown there. So China imports loads of wheat sending up the prices on the international market. Is that it?
Right.
So Egypt can't afford to buy enough.
Yeah, that's the simple take-home message. Also, before the event in China, there was drought and extreme fires in Russia. So Russia, Ukraine also didn't have the wheat harvest that they usually have. So we see the whole market really being exacerbated, and the Chinese drought was at the end of this. So there wasn't the wheat supply to go to different parts of the world. We also have to remember that a place like China has the money, the shipping power, et cetera, all the contacts that if there's a competition, China will get the wheat before Egypt will, because it's just a more powerful nation.
And is it a matter of power or organization? I mean, is it partly that maybe central planning, one of the advantages in a context like that?
It's really organization and what's important in society. So social stability is what the Communist Party thinks will enable to stay in power. So they do many of these. They look ahead. They plan. They invest money in things that they feel will personally threaten them. So climate might threaten them, but what we really see is that it had greater impact on Middle East countries.
So in the Middle East, I mean, which countries are we talking about? Is it just Egypt?
No, it's the top nine wheat importing countries are all in the Middle East.
Goodness.
So, right. So it's Libya, it's Jordan, it's Emirates, Syria, not Syria, but countries in the region.
Right. And were they taken by surprise?
It appears they were taken by great surprise. And also it reflects on governance, because Egypt used to produce more wheat, but they shifted away to money crops like mangoes and flowers that made money for the elites that were well connected within the Mubarak regime. So part of it's a choice of governments of where they stress their limited agricultural abilities.
Gosh, that's fascinating. So the political setup in a country, the fact that the elites were basically in it for themselves and not taking enough interest in the people, meant that you got change of crops, which made them more vulnerable to international shocks.
Right.
God, and how far are the problems that we saw in the Arab Spring, the uprisings and so on? How far can those be connected directly to the wheat shortage?
In a paper I wrote, I presented the idea that it has a direct impact, a direct circumstantial impact. So
does that mean?
We can't take a bushel of wheat and say that this belongs in the Middle East, or last year this would have gone in the Middle East. But what it does, because of the vast size of the Chinese market, through the commodities and the speculation of these commodities, there's this idea that there's not the wheat available that there usually is in the market.
Right. Okay.
So it's redistributing a limited good to where it doesn't go to where it usually would go in its normal patterns.
But the link between wheat being available in these countries and the social unrest, is that very clear?
Well, it is quite clear. In Egypt at the time, if one pays attention to the Arab Spring in 2011, there were the political protests going on in Tahrir Square, but equally there were food protests at the same time in Egypt, and we saw the waving of the bread as a symbol for the inability of the government to provide the basics for the population. So people actually first died from the wheat protest rather than the political protest, and then in February 2011 they merged together. But it's the idea in a country like Egypt that's poor and a third of their calories come from wheat, from bread, that if the government's not able to provide this basic sustenance, that political upheaval follows.
Right, and did the same apply in other nearby countries?
Well, there is some issues, yes, in Jordan, in Libya. We see some of these things happening. Syria, surprisingly, was much more productive agriculturally. So the CIA particularly said there was no risk for any government change or collapse in Syria because of the food issues. But we see that actually
were other causes.
The food supply, yeah, you know, was a big issue in other parts of the region, though there wasn't the same revolution like in Egypt.
Right, okay. But so the CIA, at least, were aware and actively considering that food shortages were likely to cause political unrest.
They were, and they decided that Syria, because it was less involved in the international food commodity markets and less involved with Western sources, was the least vulnerable in the Middle East.
Right, okay.
That's 2011.
Yeah. Now, am I right in, you have a number of colleagues working on similar problems elsewhere? So we've talked here about the Gobi Desert or the Gobi region and its impact in the Middle East. Can you give other examples?
Sure. In geography, there's a strong focus on climate modeling, identifying climate patterns. And so this is taking the information we have and trying to highlight or pinpoint where we might have stresses and problems in the future. So a lot of this happens in Africa, the Middle East region. What the challenge is to bring the climate data together with the social or human understanding of what happens in these areas. Politics is always quite uncertain. So the modeling and the data approach can't address the uncertainties of human life, but there's a great interest in what might trigger events in the future.
So these issues tend to be concentrated in the Middle East and Africa, do they? Is that where most of the impacts are?
That's where we're seeing the more direct political impacts, because we should also be aware of the environments in these areas, low precipitation, growing populations, inability to grow food to supply your own population. So then they're more at risk in the international marketplaces and events.
Right. I mean, what about Southern Asia, say? I mean, India and Pakistan, there are notorious tensions. One can imagine sea level rise and other climate changes there might.
What we could really imagine that area is what happens to the glaciers of the Himalayas that feed the Ganges
right.
and water, and these waters that contribute to the food supply of hundreds of millions of people. Drought was mentioned earlier. It could be a glacial melt or other processes like this, flooding, of course, that upset the patterns by which we live.
So, Kate, given what we've talked about so far, it'd be good to get your perspective on where you think all this is heading. What do you think the future holds if the effects of climate change increase and become more widespread?
Well, I wish I had a crystal ball to show where and what threats are coming. I think we all do. But as Troy was saying, what we really hope to do is take the existing climate models that exist, you know, made by scientists all around the world, by organizations like the IPCC, that spend years putting together really tailored models of what climate impacts are expected in every region of the world. And so what it takes for social scientists like us is to start extending those models and figure out what are the second, third, fourth order consequences of those natural environmental shifts and changes, and how does that start interacting with the political system, the human social systems that are in place on the ground. And I can say, having looked at some of the scenarios, both for near-term warming, remember, we've already increased the temperature by 1 degree centigrade globally from historic averages. So that's just at 1 degree, we're kind of seeing the impacts that we have now. What happens at 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees, even 4 degrees, which is what the models say we're currently on track for without any significant changes. And what we can see in those scenarios is there is no region of the world that is unaffected there.
Literally none.
So what happens is that at lower scenarios of warming, unfortunately, the most fragile states and the most fragile regions are facing the biggest impacts. So that's, as Troy said, places in Africa, places in the Middle East. Along that equator line, you see states facing untoward impacts, unfortunately, that they are really the least responsible for in some ways, because they've put much fewer tons of CO2 up into the atmosphere than northern countries.
Though, as Troy was saying, part of their fragility may come because of the way those states themselves are organized.
Absolutely. So fragility itself is a measure of your stability, your governance system, your ability to respond to shocks as they hit you. So if the unfortunately the regions of the world are also places that are at risk of severe climate changes are also states which are seen as fragile or in some cases failing states, how are those situations going to respond to these climate shocks? It's really terrifying. And then as you keep turning up that temperature dial, obviously those shocks become more frequent and more intense in those regions around the world. There are some regions of the world in the Middle East that at certain scenarios of warming could become entirely uninhabitable because of the just temperature outside is unable to support life. And how do those impacts start crossing borders, start crossing regions, start destabilizing political systems?
Because of migration, is that the main issue?
But as well as, you know, if you have a transboundary water source that potentially now countries are able to share, think of the Nile in Egypt and Ethiopia, has been a very effective water sharing agreement between those countries. What happens when those water levels start changing? The agreement itself might become, no longer applicable, and already you're seeing increased rhetoric and increased tension among these two countries today.
Picking up on Kate's point, the Ethiopian government is completing the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. So this will greatly change the water supply availability and seasonality on the Nile. So it doesn't take into any of these climate factors that Kate mentions, but yet it's between the governments. So the previous power sharing agreement where Egypt gets 90% of the Nile water will not hold because Ethiopia now can physically restrain it.
And did it discuss this with Egypt before putting it in place?
Yeah, they are both aware of it. And in 2012, Egypt said they would blow up the dam. They haven't done that. They've discussed it, and this will affect the rate at which the dam fills up. But it's a great point of contention because we don't know what will happen with this great control on the
so what's Nile's the floor. Current situation with regard to the dam?
It's nearing completion.
Is it actually functioning at the moment?
It's almost functioning. It's almost completed the building. So,
but it's not yet stopping the flow.
Not yet.
Goodness me. So this is kind of imminent, is it, within the next year or so?
Absolutely. It's been well discussed by the parties, by international groups as well. And also remember, Sudan's in between these two countries. They want to have a say as well. But with agriculture being so important in these areas and high population growth, the water and the ability to grow productive agriculture is very important for all these countries.
But I mean, what we know about politicians maybe around the world, but certainly close to home, is that they tend not to be terribly good at anticipating things and rather too focused on the here and now. My guess would be that once the water flow starts genuinely being affected, the political temperature is going to rise very, very quickly.
Yeah, that's the world waits to find out what will happen.
Yeah, this is one of those hotspots that scholars and security professionals watch, right? As you already have a tense situation, as I said, and any little amount of change, let alone climate change, changing the situation on the ground will just multiply those threats and could lead to outcomes that otherwise might have been contained.
And presumably these outcomes are pretty much unpredictable, right? I'm thinking, looking at the recent history of British and American politics, say, leave aside more fragile regions, you'd be hard put to have predicted 10 years ago what's happened since in all sorts of ways. Tiny little things like hanging chads in Florida or whatever can completely change the course of political development in a country. So when you've got a whole load of countries together all facing change, is there any prospect for predicting what's going to happen other than that it's going to be chaotic?
So there are trends you can map, right?
So
politically, rises in ethno-nationalist responses to migration flows, that's a trend, that's something that you can map and say where else might be affected by that, how might that shift and change institutions as migration itself increases. you can map that out. What is difficult and what forecasters are always scared of, especially when it comes to climate change, are surprises or what are called fat tail risks. So these are high impact, low probability risks.
Can you give examples?
Sure. So that might be, you know, the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet far sooner than anyone would expect. That could be some big event that kind of collapses a bunch of permafrost in the northern Arctic region. And unfortunately, what happens then is a lot of methane gas is released that was stored up in that permafrost. And that big release of methane gas causes the global temperature to increase really quickly. And these are genies that can't necessarily be put back in the bottle, right? You can't refreeze the Arctic, or sorry, you can't refreeze the Antarctic. You can't refrost the permafrost. And so these fat tail risks might have untold consequences all around the globe.
And when you say fat tail, just to put this in context, this is the kind of thing where some people might say, oh, you're scaremongering. The chance of that happening is very small. Fat tail means, yeah, it may be small, but it's not negligible. I mean, maybe there's a 1% chance or a 5% chance or something. But actually, if it happened, it would be so catastrophic that we ought to be taking this seriously. Have I got that right?
Exactly. Yep. And so if you think of a curve, the curve of probability might be high at the left-hand side, but as you get to the right-hand side, that curve decreases. But as you say, the catastrophic risk of those events are ones that make you want to pay attention to them.
Another thing to go along with this is population, I think, and population growth, particularly in poorer countries, makes them more vulnerable to these climate shocks because there's a limited amount of food out there, limited amount of water supply. An issue in my region in China is pollution of water, of contaminants on the soil. So can we grow enough food and have enough drinkable water for what seems like inexorably expanding populations? And studying deserts, you see this because they're already fragile environments and there's not an ability to squeeze out very much more productivity because you don't have the rainfall or the water, or you don't have the soils or the ability to increase your production.
That's very interesting because you're talking about China, which notoriously brought in a one-child policy for quite a long time. Do you think we'd be looking at a very different situation if they hadn't done that?
That's a very interesting question. I don't think so, because what we're seeing now is China needs more people to support its society economically, and they don't have that. So they made a decision that went one direction, but not planning these other consequences. It's kind of like you said, our government's able to predict and operate in the future as opposed to just in the immediate
present. But without the one-child policy, I take it the population in China would now be bigger than it actually is.
Yes.
So would not these problems be worse?
They might be worse or exacerbated now, but also they might be dealt with in a more contemporary time frame instead of being postponed to some point in the future.
I see. So it may be that the population now is expanding just at the time when these other climate impacts are coming in, and that makes it more difficult to deal with than it would have been earlier, is that?
Actually, China's an unusual case. The population isn't so much expanding as the productivity is reached its maximum levels, because as they've gotten richer, the cities have expanded greatly. The agricultural land has decreased. So actually, they're taking land out of production at a time when their demand increases, and with their greater wealth, their food patterns have changed. So they don't want just the vegetables. Meat's important, and that contributes to other climate factors, and it more intensifies the food supply, which is a challenge to satisfy.
But population is one of those trends that, you know, you have to throw in the mix. You can't ignore the fact that many of the fastest growing regions of the world are also those that are at severe risk of climate impacts. So that's Southeast Asia, that's places like Bangladesh, that's cities on the coast of Southeast Asia, and that's places in the Middle East like Palestine, which are rapidly still growing and will have youth bulges at the time that a lot of these climate risks start really coming home to roost.
And youth bulges are important, what? Because the youth tend to be very active and they're more likely to migrate and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, active will migrate, will protest, will hold their government accountable for lack of provision of services.
Or young people might become radicalized.
Sure. I mean, radicalization is a big problem anywhere in the world of youth populations that have gone, you know, unaddressed. Their needs have gone unaddressed. And as Troy said, growing populations just mean more strain on systems that are already going to be strained by climate reasons.
Back in the 18th century, famously, Malthus came out with these predictions about the awful things that would happen if the population was allowed to multiply, because it goes up geometrically and the food supply only goes up at best arithmetically, and therefore population will end up dominating, so we all ought to be abstinent and marry later and all that sort of thing. Now, you in fairly recent years, a lot of people have been saying, oh, that's just, you know, scaremongering. In fact, no such crisis has occurred. We shouldn't listen to people like Malthus who warn about growth of population. What would you say about that?
Oh, man. So my take on Malthusian kind of population situations are we don't have scarcity in the world. We have vast inequality. And some people have far more resources than others, be they monetary, be they food, be they clothing and education opportunities. And what I would say is we need to better balance how we distribute resources across the world within our societies to allow everyone to be resilient to the shocks that are coming. And it's less about, you know, production needs to be shut off entirely, and more about we need to be helping each society to be resilient. And that means providing resources to them.
So just to clarify, are you saying that the population of the world in itself is not a problem? The problem is the inequality.
That is what I think is by far the biggest problem.
Troy's made the point that you get a larger population, you need more wheat, right? People eat more. If you reduce the inequality in the world, arguably the climate is going to degrade quicker, you'll get less food, and you've got that greater population.
I just never kind of take the population solution first priority, because I think, as we've seen in China and other cases, that has just awful consequences on women in the societies, in the regulation of women's bodies in those societies. And so I think anytime that we come up on a conversation where we say, oh, the solution here is to limit the population, we should first look at the other issues.
Yes.
And that is access to education, access to resources. And what we see in communities across the globe is when people feel secure in their homes, secure in their livelihoods, they make different decisions in terms of their reproductive outcomes. And if they don't, I don't think that's to us to demonize.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So basically, if you can be confident that children are going to survive to adulthood, you have fewer of them, and so forth.
Sure. Or if you have your own kind of educational opportunities to pursue, you might be.
Yeah. You don't see your only role in life as producing children. Yeah, Troy.
Well, I might also look at it as there's environmental inequality as well in what can be produced. So we sit here in Oxford, have this discussion, but we're in a green and lush land where many things can be grown. If you sit there in Jordan or Rajasthan in India or the Sahara and look around, there's just low productivity, yet we see growing populations. So the stress of climate change will perhaps have a greater impact in these countries that are probably less organized or less able to mitigate the effects of it.
Lack of stability is not innocent, right?
No, no.
There are vast systems and inequalities that have been forced on many of those places of the world. Through imperialism and through other kind of historical political trends that have put them and kept them in that situation. But I actually think this is one of those other trends to watch. As climate changes, what happens to blame? What happens to kind of political trends among countries where some are facing vast consequences and others are not? Kind of how does that destabilize interstate relations further?
Yeah, yeah. And the relative lack of power of international bodies is a problem here, I take it.
Yeah, so I think not with every climate impact, but certainly Some climate impacts are so intense or strike certain regions of the world where there is already, vast superpower interest or kind of global interest. And in certain situations, those could rise to destabilize entire regions, rise to destabilize kind of global relations. And it just depends. It depends, if a hurricane strikes New Orleans and the United States, that might engender a statewide response and a national response, but wouldn't necessarily require any international layer of response. But if impact strikes already failing states or broad regions, you might see calls for UN response or calls for superpower response just to help fix the situation and contain it from spreading even further. On the flip side, what my research is beginning to look at is, might superpowers in a kind of dog-eat-dog realist version of the world start taking advantage of shocks that hit adversaries or destabilize regions from a relative power perspective?
For example, I mean, Russia is often accused, is it not, of intervening in the Middle East, partly motivated by destabilizing things, causing migration problems to Europe.
Right. Well, the Putin regime in Russia certainly took advantage of the refugee flows out of Syria, out of the Middle East, through disinformation campaigns and online ad targeting to further kind of fuel the flames of ethno-nationalism in Europe.
And it arguably contributed them by bombing there or allowing bombing there, right? I mean, that might have been the motive.
I think Putin has many motives when it comes to Syria. The destabilization of Europe is certainly a factor there. But certainly what we might see is just more of these things happening, more messing around in other regions on the back of climate impacts. And that is very scary when it comes to global security.
Right. And can you see this potentially leading to a conflict between superpowers rather than, as it were, superpowers interfering here and there for their own ends?
Yeah, where I think that is most likely, and who can judge likelihood in quantitative terms, but where that is most likely is in a region like the Arctic. So in a currently ungoverned, yes, this is actively another one of those hotspots. So the Arctic, which is currently ungoverned, it's not divided up like the Antarctic is. There is no treaty governing it. There is an institution like the Arctic Council, which is more flexible and trying to regulate the variety of activities there. As the Arctic melts and sea ice, particularly in summer months, melts and becomes more open, you see countries like China increasingly want to use those very valuable shipping routes that cut, entire weeks off of global shipping times. And so what you've seen is an increased military and increased kind of security posturing among superpowers in the Arctic. China kind of trying to come into the Arctic Council and say it is an Arctic neighbor that deserves to be at the table there. And so it's a real test of international cooperation. Do we have the institutions we need that are fit for purpose to handle those changes and increasing tensions as they arise in the Arctic? Or might that be an area where one small spark might lead to something worse?
A different take on the role of superpowers is the absence of the superpower. Like, where is China and anything happening in the Middle East this last decade? Or can we trust the U.S. to actually do things, we might say, for the benefit of other countries?
Because it tends to be isolationist.
Right. If you're going to be isolationist, you'll let the country, the Africans or the Middle East or whatever, collapse, whether it's driven by climate or governance or population issues like that. So maybe the role isn't just military where they do the destruction, but how do they alleviate or ameliorate conditions in other parts of the world that they have the ability to?
Right. And what do you think is going on here? I mean, is it just sort of denialism?
They don't seem to see a responsibility, though.
Right.
We could argue the U.S. has done very well out of globalization and
yes,
has enjoyed its century of leadership. But where is their responsibility to help the rest of the global society?
Okay. So do you think, Kate was mentioning this issue of responsibility too, and do you think that's it? It's not denial over what's happening. It's saying that's none of our business.
Right.
They ought to look after themselves.
And maybe Trump looks at China and says, look, China's not doing anything. Why do we have to do anything in these parts of the world?
Right. But presumably your perspective on that is what? That if that actually from America's own interest, it can't turn its back.
Right. Even if it's just its own interest, it needs to participate in the global society.
Because chaos is going to end up impacting.
And maybe they need to shift away from spending their money only on military to other maybe more beneficial ways of engagement.
Right.
So speaking of the U.S. military, this is actually something of great interest to the U.S. military. It has for years, almost decades, kind of tracked environmental change as a stressor, as a potential threat to global stability. And since 2008-09, the intelligence services of the United States government and of the kind of security apparatus has constantly called out climate change as a worldwide threat, as something that will threaten U.S. national security as well as kind of global stability because of all the things we've been talking about. One way that that's very clear is the U.S. military is often called upon to perform humanitarian response in places like the Philippines when Typhoon Haiyan struck in 2014. The U.S. military, the U.S. Navy was there on the ground providing that humanitarian response. And what happens when those type of shocks become more frequent, the calls on a global kind of police force or a global humanitarian force like the U.S. military just becomes that much kind of more in demand.
And you can imagine some Americans saying, look, we've got enough problems with hurricanes in the U.S. What are we sending our people abroad?
Definitely. And that's kind of that push and pull of isolationism, right? As climate impacts, again, become more frequent and more intense around the world, do we cooperate better? Do we work together to respond and save lives where we can? Or do we all pull inside our borders and try to, you know, in a defensive crouch, only secure those places? It's pretty bleak.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. I was struck by what you said about the Arctic. I have to say that was a complete surprise. What? You'd think the Arctic, that area, there's so little there, relatively speaking.
There is a lot there.
Worth having a global conflict over?
There are vast, vast stores of fossil fuels, of oil and gas and minerals that countries want their hands on. So you've seen kind of that increased tension grow over the past few years as countries stake claims, as countries, you know, I think Russia would love to have, as Sherry Goodman with the Center for Climate and Security says, a global toll road across the Arctic where, you know, you have to pay Russia to kind of use that shipping lane. And as these security presences just grow in that area, you are at larger risk of something setting a conflict.
Yeah, and that's just, as you say, sometimes a small spark can light a huge flame. I mean, actually, in the last season of Future Makers, we were talking about artificial intelligence. And one of the issues there was military systems being made subject to automatic control in order to produce rapid responses. So essentially, you can knock the enemy out before they get you. If that sort of development goes on, then there's all the more scope, unfortunately, for little things, maybe a conflict over shipping lanes in the Arctic to escalate to something bigger.
Definitely. What I think is important and an important distinction to draw from AI, however, though I suppose AI is in this boat too, it's not inevitable. These threats are not inevitable. And though Troy and I spend our days in future scenarios that would depress even the most hardy security professional, those are possibilities, but they're possibilities that we can prevent.
Yeah, but that requires anticipating them.
It requires anticipating them.
Things are largely dominated by opportunistic dictators on the one hand, maybe, and free market people on the other who are against the idea of central control, you've got a real problem, haven't you?
Sure, but I think even those most kind of selfish perspectives would see that there is no greater threat to global economic stability, to global national stability, personal stability, than preventing some of these futures, right? And so that is what I think we're seeing as the pictures become more clear of horribleness to come. We can actually prevent some of those futures from happening from mitigating climate change now. And every ton of CO2 in the atmosphere matters because each of those temperature increases are worse than the last, right?
Maybe it's not time to wait for the governments to take the action, but like Extinction Rebellion, for people themselves to take the action first.
Right, and actually force our governments to take these things
seriously. They'll come behind, yeah.
That's been such an interesting conversation. I'd just like to end, if I may, by asking you to sum up. Troy, are you overall optimistic or pessimistic? Is there going to be a global conflict or maybe a global profusion of local conflict?
There aren't that many wars that we can identify as being climate-driven. Often the challenges are within societies and the distribution of resources. So I'd like to be hopeful that wars won't be driven over transboundary wires or things like this, that we'll be able to work together well enough to get by like we do now. We kind of limp along, but I don't think climate will be the final factor.
That's an optimistic take, but yes. What I've been listening to in our conversation is that the problems are kind of accelerating, and given how poor we are at agreeing international treaties and things with any speed, why are you optimistic?
Well, I think it's the human element that we need to worry about more than the climate element.
Sure, but we need to worry very seriously about the human element, don't we? Isn't there a risk that everything's going to become chaotic just very quickly?
I would say the climate won't be the key feature. At the very start, Kate mentioned it as a threat multiplier. I think it's the human action, the political will, and the ability to deal with existing challenges. The climate won't be the key feature in these instances. It'll be problems that are already existing. Where can societies adapt to take care of their populations? That we're going to have these challenges with population, with nationalism, irregardless of what climate does. Hopefully, the climate issues and the environment is something that can supersede the nationalism or the economic interest that seems to be the big driver today.
So I see. So that's an interesting note of optimism then, that the crisis that we see over the climate could kick the population into saying, hey, we need politicians who can actually think about these things and deal with them and start thinking more about the future rather than just reacting to...
Right, or maybe drive some more political will to address these things.
Towards international cooperation and so on. That's very interesting. Kate, what's your overall view, optimistic or pessimistic?
Words out of my mouth. No, I think the risks are unimaginable, frankly. The scenarios that we dwell in are horrific, and they are, as we've said throughout this, touching every part of the world. And if we don't deal with that, we will quickly face the repercussions of those decisions. On the flip side and on the optimistic side, I think because we know it's coming, because we can see almost a roadmap of where destabilization might occur or these hotspots might flare up, we can prevent them. And imagine if somebody had given the leaders in, 1940 a roadmap to what might happen in World War II.
Or
1914, or, turn of the century, what might happen? And you could build institutions to prevent those worst human impulses from coming out. That is exactly my hope. And that's, I think, where we have untold opportunity globally that we've never had. We all are facing extreme risks. As we've said, there are going to be no winners at the end of the century if we let climate change continue on the path that it is. And so we actually have huge global interests overlapping to cooperate and to build institutions that can contain these risks. And if there's no other bright spot, it's that if we don't, the risks are catastrophic. So potentially this could bring us together in ways we haven't yet come together.
Well, that's a very nice note on which to finish, and let us hope. Thank you so much. That's been a really interesting discussion.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My thanks to Kate and Troy for making this such a fantastic discussion. I'd also like to ask you, as a listener to Future Makers, what you think. Does the prospect of global climate conflict worry you? Or from the discussion today, do you think it's unlikely to happen? Let us know in the comments and feedback through your podcast provider, and we'll try to address these questions in our future shows. And with the holiday season approaching, why not give the gift of Future Makers to a friend? Tell them about the show, or just subscribe them to it when they're not looking. In our final episode of this season, And as we've spent a lot of time talking about the problems of climate change, we're going to investigate potential solutions and whether these will come from utilising nature, our engineering minds, or somewhere in between. Until then, I'm Peter Millikan, and you've been listening to Future Makers.